Mr. Jensen.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm David Jensen. I represent Medical Assurance. We're appealing from a July 8, 2008 order issued by the late Judge Sharp, which stayed any further proceedings on a declaratory judgment action that Medical Assurance filed against Mark Weinberger, M.D., four Weinberger entities, and in excess of 300 plaintiffs. Currently, there are 352 claims that have been filed against Weinberger and Weinberger entities, some of which are being processed at the Indiana Department of Insurance. Weinberger is an international fugitive who has lost his medical license in the state of Indiana. There are extensive findings from an order by the Indiana Medical Licensing Board in 2007. Believing that Weinberger had violated the terms of various policies issued by Medical Assurance from the late 1990s on, Medical Assurance filed a declaratory judgment action. The response on the part of the district court was to have the parties brief the issue of whether or not it should abstain from making any decision in this case until, quote, all of the pending matters were concluded.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to clarify, at least, because I can't find this spot right now, but some of your opponents have implied in their briefs that maybe some sampling of the cases could be concluded, and your position does appear to be that all 352 cases have to go through the full medical panel plus then state court proceeding. And I realize how theoretical this sounds from your point of view, but if it turns out you have no duty to defend after that, you can try to find Dr. Weinberger for reimbursement. So do you think it's a sample, or do you think that it's all cases?
What Judge Sharp has done is he has said that we are stayed until, quote, all of the cases are completed. And that means that we have 352 cases, some of which are currently pending at the Indiana Department of Insurance. And it is important because this is a platypus, unique in the, certainly in the Midwest and probably in most of the states of the United States. Indiana has a 1975 Medical Malpractice Act, which requires, with a couple of exceptions that do not apply here, every claim that asserts medical negligence must first be submitted to a panel of three physicians who will review the panel, will review whatever evidence the parties want to put in front of it, and then render an opinion, which is an expert opinion, about whether or not the evidence submitted establishes whether there has been a deviation from the standard of care, and if so, whether there's causation.
If there's a deviation, then suppose it advances to the next step, which would be, let's say, filing a suit. Let's say there's a malpractice injury. I'm being a little bit hypothetical here. I know there's all kinds of other things that could come in. Would that then mature to what you would call a parallel case?
No, sir. There is no parallel proceeding that will ever take place here under Wilton. It is an impossibility.
But let's focus on this a little bit. I realize that your position, I think, is that insurance companies who are trying to challenge a duty to defend basically have two choices. They can do what you appear to be doing in these four cases that have actually graduated beyond the panel stage and defend under reservation of rights, or they can bring an action for declaratory judgment. You brought an action for declaratory judgment. You invoked federal jurisdiction for that action. So you are obviously not the malpractice plaintiff suing the doctor, and in that sense, your action, as you say, will never be parallel to malpractice patient versus doctor. But on the other hand, encompassed within those proceedings is often kind of an ancillary proceeding where the insurance company will seek a declaration that it has no duty to defend, and often, you know, obviously duty to indemnify happens later. So I'm interested in really trying to see what standard of review applies here. Your brief relies very heavily on the abstention cases, but But on the other hand, it's the Wilton case that focuses on declaratory judgments, and I want to know why that isn't actually the proper standard for us to turn to here.
Well, you'll recall that in Wilton, we had a federal court action filed by the Hill Group with regard to litigating whether or not it was required to indemnify that group for the judgment that was rendered in the Texas state court. And at the same time, there was a declaratory judgment action filed by the Hill Group in state court against the insurers, raising the very same issues. So the Supreme Court, which was very, very careful to say, we are not deciding whether this doctrine applies when there are, quote, no parallel proceedings, could say that the insurance companies in this case could repair to state court and ventilate the same issues in state court that they were seeking to ventilate in federal court. The parties were identical. The issues were identical. All of these issues were the rights and liabilities of the insurance company with regard to whether or not it had to indemnify the Hill Group for the judgments that were rendered against it in Texas state court. Same thing, same parties, same everything, which builds right on Brillart, which was exactly the same thing, whether the state garnishment proceedings, in which the reinsurer was brought in as a defendant, was sufficient to allow it in Missouri state court to ventilate the issues of whether or not, under the unique circumstances where the defendant was bankrupt and where the insurer, the primary insurer, had gone into reorganization, whether the reinsurer had any obligation to pay on the judgment. But in our case, there is no parallel proceeding. There are no identity of the parties. There's not even a substantial identity of the parties. And remember, Judge Sharp tells us in his order at page 9 that the parallel proceedings are the IDOI proceedings, which is a determination which is non-binding on anyone by three physicians whether or not Dr. Weinberger violated the standards of care and skill. To the best of my knowledge, there has never been a court which has held that a determination by an expert panel that is non-binding on anyone as a precursor to a state court tort action is somehow or another a parallel proceeding to a declaratory judgment filed by an insurance company to determine whether or not a cooperation clause has been violated. So the Wilton-type analysis, properly applied in the right case, which is an expansive discretion given to the trial court, doesn't apply here, because the parallelism doesn't exist. And to say that the IDOI proceedings are parallel to what we wanted to do is to divest parallelism of all meaning at all. It is a Humpty Dumpty world.
So suppose you're right about that. There's another problem that your opponents raise, and that's really when a claim for a duty to defend claim is ripe for adjudication in Indiana because Indiana has an actual prejudice standard. And as I understand, frankly, I'm going to ask your opponents about this too. As I understand the net result of Judge Sharp's case, he seems to be saying you just can't bring a suit for a declaratory judgment if the ground for resisting your duty to defend is a cooperation clause.
Yeah.
You know, maybe if there was an exclusion for cosmetic surgery or something, it could be adjudicated now because that's on the paper, but a cooperation clause, you'll never know if there was actual prejudice until the case is over.
I think that's a fair reading, but we never had the evidentiary record. We never had the motion for summary judgment. We never even had the opportunity to present the totality of Indiana law to show that that which relies upon two federal court cases and no Indiana cases, because the Motorist Mutual case, which has ramifications on the Diltz case, is to the contrary. But if we were up here arguing on a summary judgment, that might be a more timely question. But Judge Sharp didn't even give us the chance to offer what we thought the evidence was, to marshal that, to submit it, and then to say to Judge Sharp, well, here is the proper standard. And if Judge Sharp and this court dealt with it in a Judge Sharp case, in the Schneider Truck Lines case, the court said, well, the federal court can make a decision. They have to make decisions with regard to complex issues of state law every day. But if there is a problem with regard to state law, the Seventh Circuit rules allow for a certification of this question to the Indiana Supreme Court. If there really is an issue with regard to whether or not actual prejudice, we have to wait to the end, you're out of court forever,
right, until
the very end, is really the standard, let's at least be able to offer to the court what we say is the proper standard under the Motorist Mutual, which deals with many other issues other than having lost a trial as the sole way to do this. Give us the opportunity to make that record, and then if you are concerned that either the law you want to apply, which comes out of Walker, a 1967 case out of this court, which looked to the Harvard Law Review for guidance on this issue and did not pay any attention to Motorist Mutual, which is decided the year before by an en banc panel of the Indiana Appellate Court, and then Cincinnati, which is a Cincinnati insurance, which is the case of the Phantom Barmaid.
Okay, before you run out of time, please tell me why you would not always have actual prejudice if, as in the case of Dr. Weinberger, you had an insured party who is absconded to Greece or Argentina or wherever.
In paragraph 27, I've given you 10 examples of the prejudice which we have sustained in this case because of his going away, including, Your Honor, the fact that the Lake Superior Court has entered an order defaulting him on 285 cases so that even if he were to appear magically again, he can't testify in any one of them and can never offer any testimony with regard to what he did or didn't do or why he did it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Blakelock.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Rich Blakelock. I'm here on behalf of the Indiana Department of Insurance Patients Compensation Fund. Also here today is Kelly Johnson, who represents the Verhoeve plaintiffs, if the Court has any particular questions on the defense of those cases. On behalf of the Patients Compensation Fund, we would request that the Court affirm Judge Sharp's ruling staying the pending coverage cases. I'd like to touch on three main issues. Number one, the practical problems and the overlap caused by the relief Medical Assurance is seeking. Secondly, discussing the actual prejudice standard. And third, discussing the standard of review and parallelism.
But here's a question that I have for you, and maybe it focuses most on your third issue, but it slips back into the others. In countless insurance cases that I can recall, when duty to defend does come up from time to time as an issue that's litigated, and unlike the usual situation with declaratory judgments, the law is filled with decisions that encourage insurance companies to use the declaratory judgment mechanism to clarify the duty to defend up front, and we actually criticize insurance companies that just sit it out and refuse to defend. We say, oh, you're rolling the dice, you know, this is a risky strategy, don't do it. So it seems to me that when we evaluate the availability of a declaratory judgment for something like this, we need to take context into account, the context here being that it's a duty to defend insurance case.
Your Honor, I think there's a couple of reactions to that. First of all, this case is unique and it is somewhat unique in the sense that we're not being asked to resolve the duty to defend simply from looking at the allegations in the complaint, which is the typical context that comes up in several of the cases that have been cited in the briefs. In a duty to defend, you compare the allegations in the complaint to the coverage in the policy and make a decision.
So you would agree that it's the state's position, it's the insurance fund's position that you can never refuse to defend in a case where the problem is a breach of the duty to cooperate. You can never get a declaratory judgment.
If that decision can be rendered on something, if that decision can be rendered from the face of the policy, then you could get a declaratory judgment. The issue here
is... Why does it have to be the face of the policy as opposed to the development of facts that don't depend on the underlying merits of the claims?
I'm not sure. Could you repeat that?
Well, your first point was that, and the district court so finds, and this may be true, we'll see, is that there's enough overlap between the underlying medical malpractice claims and these issues about the failure to cooperate and actual prejudice that it's really, I think you're essentially saying, it would be inefficient to go ahead and have the declaratory judgment because each case is going to be different. All right. Suppose there were ways of showing actual prejudice that were completely independent of the merits of the underlying medical malpractice claims, but that you would need to conduct some discovery, and so you couldn't just sit there and read the contract carefully and know the same way you might if there was an exclusion for cosmetic surgery where you just said, okay, this is a cosmetic procedure, we're not going to have to defend. Why isn't this set of cases that don't depend on the merits of the claims also something that you could get a declaratory judgment on?
I think you could in that situation, and that's the situation that you just described is distinct from this case in that there is no way to determine whether the insurance company has been prejudiced without delving into the merits of the underlying case.
Now, they contest that. They have lots of pages in their brief where they say, well, that's actually not true. Suppose we just held them to that, said, you know, if this case is going to go forward, you can't introduce any evidence that touches on the merits of the underlying claims.
I think that would be contrary to the Cincinnati insurance case, which says the only way to determine that prejudice is to see if the judgment is less favorable to the insurer, but because of the duty to cooperate.
All right, so that takes me back to my first question. So your real position is that there is simply no declaratory judgment available in the state of Indiana if the breach of the contract is a breach of the duty to cooperate.
And
zero.
And the only way to establish that is to look at the facts in the underlying case.
No, but we agreed that there's another way to establish it, the facts in the underlying case. But you think only if you lose the underlying case would there be actual prejudice?
Correct.
So you can never know, you can never get a declaratory judgment in advance because the case hasn't been resolved yet.
In this particular context, yes. And the court in the Cincinnati
insurance
case.
And you never would be able to in a duty to cooperate case. Your position is the only way you can show actual prejudice is by losing the underlying case. So there's always going to be a duty to defend.
In this particular circumstance, yes.
Okay.
Yes. And Your Honor, in the Cincinnati insurance case, the court talks about the some policy reasons behind that conclusion. And it says that as impalatable as it may be, the insurance company takes the risk that their insured will not cooperate and will flee and be unavailable to assist them with the trial.
It seems to me that will have the effect of driving up the price of insurance premiums in Indiana and also causing insurance companies to exit Indiana because you are asking insurance companies to insure people who may vanish. And so they won't have the benefit of their insured's input into the case. They'll just have to pay just as that's what medical insurance is trying to avoid.
Well, Your Honor, all it would do would shift that risk to the patient's compensation fund, which with medical assurance currently, it would spread the additional costs that it might have to undertake to its insureds. If it falls back on the patient's compensation fund, defending these cases gets spread out to all citizens.
Sure, as opposed to, you know, if physicians can't get malpractice insurance, though, I mean, at least if you believe the doctors, I don't know who one is supposed to believe, you know, they'll all exit the state of Indiana and you won't have to worry about malpractice at all because they won't be there.
Your Honor, if I what I'd like to do is walk through a situation based on a case that now has already gone through the panel process to explain what I believe Judge Sharp correctly concluded was a significant potential of overlapping cases and conflicting results.
This is only one of, only about four cases have gone through this process?
Four have gone through the process.
Glacial process, isn't it?
Well, we're not in charge of that process, Your Honor. That's a,
not blaming you, but
yeah,
it's really
slow. It has been a
slow.
Long time. That is correct. And to your point, Judge, there's nothing in Judge Sharp's ruling that prevents Medical Assurance from attempting to revisit the stay. I don't believe that, with all due respect to Mr. Jensen, that he quoted the order correctly. It says this case is stayed pending resolution of the underlying state claims. It doesn't say all of them, and there is our view of this order that once the first case goes through to trial, if there is an adverse judgment, then that case would be ripe for consideration, and they don't have to wait for the remaining 351 cases to get there.
Could that, if that case were to go through and let's say they lose, and then they're prejudiced, is that an opportunity for the court then to look at the whole impact of all these other cases, that whether or not they have a duty to defend?
I don't think so, Judge. The law...
So it's confined to the one case?
It's confined to the one case, correct. I mean, the law...
And what if they sit it out?
I'm sorry?
They sit it out, they don't... They take the risk. Then you guys got to defend, right?
We defend, yeah.
So you don't want that to happen.
We do not, and I'll explain why, Your Honor.
Well, I can understand why. You don't need to explain that. But I think what we've got here is this dilemma. You want them to be exposed to every case and have to defend every one of them.
Right. And they, by the way, they took on the underwriting risk. The Patient's Compensation Fund.
That risk, I admit
yeah,
that.
They chose to insure Dr. Weinberger. The Patient's Compensation Fund is obligated to pay this excess amount, the $1 million, and accept a surcharge amount. We don't go
but
out.
But there's a cap, is there not, under the Indiana correct. System as to what the most that could be recovered?
Right. Currently it's $1.25 million.
Right.
What if
that
they just
correct.
Pay all that into court? Just say, all right, we're not going to defend it. 350 cases. We're going to pay $1.25 million. And then they
well,
can fight over
it. It would actually be significantly more than that because you have several policy periods, and I believe we may be back up here disputing how if they put enough in or through their policies. But
I'm trying to look at alternatives here because
right.
that is a lot of cases, and I think they were mostly filed after they disappeared.
Yeah, all but three.
Yeah, so everybody jumped on it thinking maybe there's something at the end of the rainbow.
That may be true.
Yeah.
And so looking at the Wanda Sipacat case, which is one of the four that's gone through, the case has gone through the panel. The panel concluded that, number one, there was a breach of the standard of duty of care, but number two, the damages complained of were less likely rather than more likely the result of the breach of the standard of care. That decision was made without the benefit, obviously, of Dr. Weinberger. The case has now been filed in Lake Superior Court. And what I'd like to do is just walk through a scenario where if back in 2007 Judge Sharp had not stayed these cases, a potential conflict that would have arisen. Medical Assurance back in 2007 would have put on some expert doctors and expert attorneys to say, well, our ability to defend the case is less or is prejudiced as a result of Dr. Weinberger not being here. And if Judge Sharp agreed and excused them of their duty to defend, the Patient's Compensation Fund would step in. We would then obviously, as you mentioned, Judge, pay for the defense of the case to go through trial. If at the trial level, the jury, and this is why you can't decide all of the cases in MASH, you can have different juries with all these cases, but if the jury then agrees with the medical review panel, which is an admissible opinion, and concludes, yeah, there was a breach of the standard of care, but no, there was no damages, you have a defense verdict. In the meantime, Medical Assurance has not complied with its obligation to defend Dr. Weinberger because ultimately there was no prejudice in the defense of the case. And
they make an argument at one point that the prejudice to them based on Dr. Weinberger's failure to cooperate is actually the transaction costs of defending 352 cases. I mean, as we all well know, this doesn't come cheaply.
Yeah, I think their argument is that because of the publicity associated with him leaving, that has brought upon them additional cases. First
well, exactly
of all,
as Judge Mannion just
right.
said.
They didn't raise that at the district court level, and so we first of all think that's is a waived issue. But secondly, that's not the type of prejudice that Indiana courts look to. I mean, it looks to the prejudice to defend a given case, not prejudice caused that resulted in a case being brought in the first place.
But prejudice only exists if you lose a case. So if a frivolous case is brought, you haven't been prejudiced because you're not going to lose it. And if a case that's just an open and shut case of malpractice is brought, you also haven't been prejudiced because there, you know, you don't really do much other than say, let's sit down and figure out how much we need to pay you. It's an odd idea of prejudice where only the ones that are fair subjects for litigation that you then lose, and I suppose you would also argue somehow you can trace the fact of your loss to Dr. Weinberger's absence, that's the only set of cases in which you think actual prejudice could be shown.
Correct.
Wow.
Following up on my illustration, if in that scenario where the Lake County District or Lake County Court concluded that there was a defense verdict, you would have had Judge Sharp back in 2007 ruling that there was prejudice, and then the trial court a few years later, if a defense verdict was reached following the medical review panel, concluding, in effect, there was no prejudice. You were able to win the case. And so that is the type of conflicting rulings that Judge Sharp recognized and that are a concern under any of the standards that have been discussed in the briefs. Contrast that with requiring medical assurance to defend these cases through trial. In that scenario, the medical assurance does have the ability to pursue Dr. Weinberger for those damages. The Allianz case...
You would agree this is pretty theoretical. That's why both of you were concerned about this. I'm sure you probably have a right of indemnification from him, too, pay.
I'm not aware of any rights that we would have against Dr. Weinberger or medical assurance under
common
the circumstances.
Law, at least in Indiana, I would think.
The question becomes, Your Honor, their position on that is they don't dispute that Allianz says what it says. They say, well, it would be uncollectible. But the point is they have that right. And, you know, stories about Dr. Weinberger is, A, that he's still around, and, B, that he's absconded with a bunch of money. So nobody really knows what's happened to him and whether or not he is deceased in any event.
With regard to the panels, with the three peer group doctors, this is, of course, a sacrifice for them to do all this. I presume it's not going to be the same panel for every case, is it?
That is correct.
So you've got different doctors examining him 350 times.
Eventually, yes.
That's a pretty big chore.
Yeah.
And I can see where that can be a very long process.
It has been and will be. But
are they compensated or are they volunteers?
There is some compensation. Yeah. But the point is, one of the points that we're trying to make, and I believe is accurate, is each of these cases has to be reviewed on its merits individually, setting aside the fact that there are 352 cases. So I see my time is concluded.
The panel, that's great. That's what we talk about, tort reform and all that sort of thing. Maybe that doctors in Indiana like that. But this is such an unusual case. I'm just wondering, does this rupture the whole system of value of insurance? And that's why I don't know what would happen if this did go back to a new judge. To what would he be able to do from your standpoint? What could he do? What would he be able to base his decision on, one way or the other, about prejudice? This is just here from your side. I'd ask him the same.
Yeah, from our side is first of all, Indiana said that an empty chair does not constitute prejudice. It also has said that if somebody dies, there's no prejudice. It's essentially the same scenario: death versus missing. And so the only way to determine that is whether this accumulation of allegations made by medical assurance that constitute prejudice ultimately result in a judgment that is less favorable to medical assurance. And there's no other way to do that. And Indiana courts have said, as impalatable as that may sound, that risk fell on medical assurance when they chose to underwrite these policies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Mr. Jensen.
Of course, medical assurance chose to underwrite these policies, in counsel's words, with a cooperation clause. And the cooperation clause is set out in the complaint. That cooperation clause has clearly been violated, and that's resulted, among other things, in the district court's order. Now, the whole issue of actual prejudice, in my judgment, shouldn't be resolved in an abstention case. It should be resolved when we have an opportunity to look at an evidentiary record and then make a determination with regard to what is the appropriate law in a case like this. As we've pointed out, the law that we believe governs is in the Motorist Mutual case, and that is the importance of all such policy provisions. This is referring to the duty to cooperate, is that the insurer obtains all necessary knowledge, to advisedly negotiate, defend, and settle claims.
So what about the death example?
Yeah.
Well, but I haven't had a client who's died who has a default judgment against him preventing him from testifying in 287 cases.
Don't think that's necessary.
Failure. I'm sorry.
No, I have a separate question for you since time is running short. You had also, I thought, based your request or for declaratory relief on the fraud exception, but you haven't said anything about that in this court. Is that gone?
It's not gone. It's stayed as well. But there, again, isn't any record that's been developed with regard to that. We basically haven't been able to do anything in this case.
But that's what I brought up before. If there's one case that does go forward, how much can be achieved if you accept the defense in that and raise these issues? Is that a possibility?
Well, here's my problem with that, Judge Mannion. We're going to have this huge bolus of cases up here. And like a penny machine, they're going to come out a penny at a time. And so the district court is going to be asked to make a decision after the resolution in 40, 70, 90.
No, I'm asking, can you do it in one? What do you expect to happen on remand if that happens?
Well,
if
I think the first thing we're going to do on remand is decide what the rules of engagement are going to be. Are we entitled to discovery? Are we entitled to put together a case that shows our prejudice?
And
if we can resolve this
under the duty to defend.
Why don't
you
just outline that a little bit?
Yes.
I mean, I appreciate the overall view of how you would go about it, but how about breaking that down so a district judge could focus on?
Okay, the first thing it seems to me is, what are the basic contentions of each of the groups of the plaintiffs, the Verhoeve plaintiffs and the Thomas plaintiffs? And those can be resolved in simple contention-type interrogatories. So we'll know what their basic contentions are. For instance, the basic contention being you never should have done the surgery to begin with. Okay, we know that that's a basic type of contention. Now, then the question becomes, it seems to me, from the standpoint of the proper application of Motorist Mutual, should we have Dr. Weinberger to tell us why he did the surgery? If he's not here to tell us, or he's precluded from telling us because of the Lake Superior Court order, haven't we been prejudiced in terms of being able to articulate to a fact finder what the basis was for him doing the surgery? We can't do it with an expert witness necessarily. So for all those kinds of cases, we have, I think, relatively easily and cheaply established that we have been prejudiced because Dr. Weinberger isn't here. Suppose the contention is you negligently failed to interpret a CT scan. Okay, that's all we have to know, because he used CT scans as a basis for documenting the endoscopic nasal surgery. All right, if he's not here to testify, to say what he saw on those CT scans that led him to believe that this was a proper and appropriate way to do it, or he is prevented from testifying because of the implementation of the Lake Superior Court order, haven't we also been prejudiced?
When is an example when you wouldn't have been?
Pardon?
When would there not be prejudice? What kind of a case that might be in that 350?
I suppose there's a case or two out there where his care was proper. And so in a case in which his care... That's right. And perhaps they then dismiss their case after the finding of the medical review panel.
In other words,
panel.
Though, it's just about everyone.
But I think it's fair to say, Judge Mannion, that we're dealing with people who are resolute in their determination because they believe that for one of several reasons he was guilty of medical negligence, and he can't ever help us to tell us why he wasn't.
Put aside that Lake Superior order for a second, Mr. Jensen.
I will.
No, but just the absence of Weinberger is prejudice, right?
Under these circumstances, it certainly is.
Well, are you going to distinguish between absence because, let's assume for the sake of argument, that he's out of the country and the FBI's put a border watch on him and all that stuff, a person like Weinberger out of the country as opposed to, you know, some other doctor who just decides to move to Utah, you know, where maybe you would be able to have an ancillary proceeding in Utah, you'd have subpoena power in Utah, you'd be able to actually get the person?
Well, we'd certainly be able to make the Utah physician testify.
Right. So in other words, Weinberger, your position is you don't know where he is, and as far as you know, he's still out of the way beyond our subpoena power at this point.
He is, as the Medical Licensing Board said, an international fugitive who planned his departure.
So what if you go back and the district court says, well, we'll have status reports every 180 days? How does this advance? What if a district judge did that? Would that be an abuse of his discretion?
But then aren't we back to Sears Roebuck that was decided in this court 39 years ago? What's the point of having a declaratory judgment relief if we basically and we have a duty to defend which is ripe because the court said that 39 years ago, and now we're being told, yes, it's right, but you can't do anything about it. You just have to cook. I just don't think a case that percolates forever is a case that's in anyone's interest, and it certainly defeats our contract rights and our ability to use the declaratory judgment statute.
Well, this certainly this court or the district court has no power to stay the state court proceedings.
And we don't expect them to be stayed. We just would like to have the opportunity to get the relief that we are entitled to in the use of the Wilton standard, and calling these IDUI proceedings as parallel is just an error.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. Court